Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we open our show with a report on the weekend's mass protests against the Trump administration held across the nation, drawing millions of people, including large turnouts across San Diego from downtown to the desert, including Borrego Springs, where more than 10% of the town's population turned out. Latinos in Acción held a press conference outside El Cajon City Hall last week after an ICE raid at a local business just outside the city limits, protesting the city council majority's recent push to cooperate with ICE. With a vacancy on the County Board of Supervisors, two candidates running for the board want to see adoption of a budget delayed until a new member can be seated, but the current board is split over that idea. A federal court has blocked federal cuts to public health funds, at least for now, thanks to a lawsuit spearheaded by California's Attorney General. A La Mesa City Councilwoman is holding a town hall meeting this week on a proposed battery storage facility in a residential neighborhood after a number of fires at battery storage facilities elsewhere sparked concern. The Trump administration has suspended many programs that help student loan borrowers, meaning steep payment hikes for many borrowers, and we'll have details. The county's health department has issued a warning not to eat shellfish caught off local waters unless it's from a certified restaurant or market due to a potentially deadly toxin that is also sickening and killing wildlife such as sea lions. Then, from California News Service, hear about a bill in the state legislature that aims to improve transparency for car buyers. The Trump administration's efforts to take back FEMA funds for disaster relief from states has been temporarily blocked by a federal court, thanks to yet another lawsuit led by California Attorney General Rob Bonta. The Grossmont Healthcare District has launched a mobile outreach library to bring health information to rural areas, senior facilities, and other sites across East County. There's a shortage in blood supply, so the San Diego County Blood Bank is holding blood drives across our region, including several coming up in East County. Learn how to find a site to roll up your sleeve and help save a life on our show today. On Destination East County, hear about some fun and festive events coming up across our region, from Lakeside's Western Days to several flower festivals, a wine festival, an aerobatics show, and a centennial celebration atop Mount Helix, among others. The Santee City Council has released its priorities for the coming year, with fire protection number one. On the Yonder Report from Public News Service, hear how Trump's efforts to dismantle the Department of Education and slash postal services stands to hurt rural communities. And finally, since April is Women's History Month, we'll be re-airing our Sounds of History segment on Helen Stoddard, a suffragist who led efforts to get California women the right to vote and helped push through a successful initiative to incorporate La Mesa as a city. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Millions of people took to the streets nationwide in 1,300 hands-off rallies to protest the dismantling of federal programs, mass firings, and erosion of rights under the Trump administration. San Diego police estimate that around 12,000 protesters participated in a hands-off rally in downtown San Diego at the Civic Center, though other estimates range as high as 20,000. Several other protests were held across San Diego County, including in the desert community of Borrego Springs here in East County, where around 300 protesters lined the roundabout. That's more than 10% of the entire population of Borrego Springs, a normally conservative community. The Borrego protesters included many seniors and veterans concerned about cuts to Social Security and veterans' services, as well as people opposed to the mass deportation of immigrants, restriction of women's health care rights, slashing of national parks budgets, and other actions of the Trump administration. Many motorists driving by honked in support of protesters. Ronna Epting, executive director of Move On, calls the national turnout extraordinary, adding, "Across the country and around the world, people came together to say we will not be silent while our rights, our futures, and our democracy are under attack. This peaceful movement is powered by everyday people, nurses, teachers, students, parents. They're rising up to protect what matters most. We are united," she concluded. "We are relentless, and we are just getting started." In Washington, D.C., an estimated 2.5 million protesters turned out. Nationwide, even President Donald Trump acknowledged around 5 million protested against his administration Saturday. The president claims that protesters were paid by liberal billionaire George Soros, but there is zero evidence of any ads for paid protesters, nor any other evidence to support that claim. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A coalition of advocacy groups and El Cajon residents held a press conference and protest on Wednesday, April 2nd, outside of El Cajon City Hall to denounce the March 27th immigration raid on a painting company in the unincorporated part of El Cajon. The protest was organized by Latinos en Acción in response to the city's recent immigration standpoints and the raid. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, several workers were arrested and charged with false documentation to work in the U.S., but no serious crimes beyond that were listed. The owner of this raided business is being charged with conspiracy to hire undocumented immigrants. Multimedia outlets have confirmed that dozens of other workers were detained temporarily outside the business until their citizenship was verified. Speakers at the conference called for accountability from the mayor and three council members who all recently voted on a resolution to allow the city's police to cooperate with federal immigration officials regarding undocumented immigrants accused or convicted of crimes. City officials confirmed that in a recent council meeting, the mayor and others met with Homan to discuss increasing cooperation with federal immigration authorities. The city's resolution calls for cooperation with ICE over undocumented immigrants who are convicted or merely accused of a crime. The Trump administration has indicated it considers anyone who crossed the border without documentation to be a criminal who can be deported. State law limits cooperation by cities to only immigrants convicted of specified serious crimes, and the U.S. Justice Department has confirmed in a letter to the city that it will not indemnify El Cajon or its police officers against any lawsuit the state might file if the city cooperates beyond what the state allows. The comments given to East County Magazine from these city officials all seem to be at odds with each other. Mayor Wells' comment on the matter, sent via email, stated that nobody knows why the business was raided. I personally doubt that it was solely to arrest people whose primary crime was to have crossed border illegally, but I have no confirmation of that. I only know what I was told by people high up in the Trump administration that the focus would be on gang members, traffickers, and people who have committed horrible crimes, and that it would take quite a while to extend to the group mentioned. I understand the fear that people have, but I suspect that it was the activists stoking it for their own purposes. Let's see what the facts bear out. El Cajon's city manager sent a comment via email as well, claiming that El Cajon staff, police, management, elected officials, etc., had no involvement in the federal law enforcement action that took place outside the city limits last week. I learned about the event when I saw a media alert. Further, the city's involvement would have been a violation of Prop 47, and we are committed to abiding the law. Lastly, Councilman Steve Gobble responded by saying that a resolution of the City Council of El Cajon, declaring the city's commitment to ensure the public safety of all residents and asserting the city's intent to comply with federal immigration law to the legal extent permissible for the sole purpose of removing violent criminals from our community. President of Latinos en Acción, Marianne Brenham, was present and spoke at the protest, saying, El Cajon's officials are using their seats to push pro-Trump resolutions that have no legal weight but do cause plenty of harm. They sow division and unfairly target their own hardworking neighbors. They endorse these mass deportation politics, and now we are seeing the results. Along with Brenham, Pedro Rios, a member of the American Friends Service Committee, spoke on Tuesday as well, stating, make no mistake, these types of actions terrorize working families and cause tremendous trauma to members of our communities. These are constituents of the elected officials that hold office in the building behind us. He added that the city officials are supposed to be held accountable for their actions. Instead, they are having secret meetings with our current administration that are seeking to deport hardworking community members. The press conference and protest ended with a coalition of 30 residents, advocates, and community attorneys hand-delivering a public records request to the city clerk. The request asked for paperwork regarding all communication of city elected officials and employees with U.S. Customs and Immigration, ICE, the Department of Homeland Security, Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, the San Diego County Sheriff, State Senator Brian Jones, and the anti-immigration group America's First Legal. The request is looking for all communications between these groups regarding enforcement of immigration law, the immigration enforcement resolution, and the immigration raid, specifically between November of 2024 to present. Along with the request for communication records, some at the protest also held signs calling for the recall of El Cajon City Councilman Phil Ortiz, whose district has a majority of Latino voters. Sergio Conte, an organizer in the recall effort, told East County Magazine that the group has gathered 76 of the required 90 signatures to put a recall election on the ballot and hopes to fulfill the signature needs in the near future. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Juliet Sanders.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is John Tidwell with an update on the county budget based on a Voice of San Diego report. Two Democratic candidates for supervisor are urging the county to delay its annual budget vote until after a now vacant District 1 seat is filled. That push appears unlikely to garner needed support from a sitting board majority, but a 2-2 political split on the county board may mean the candidates get their wish by default. Imperial Beach Mayor Paloma Aguirre and Chula Vista Mayor Carolina Chavez argued Wednesday that residents of the South Bay District deserve a voice during the county's upcoming budget process. Mayor Aguirre called on supervisors to adopt an interim budget now, with the full-year budget voted on after a new board member is seated, to avoid shortchanging communities. Chavez said District 1 is historically underserved, and also called on the four supervisors to wait until the new South Bay supervisor can vote on the budget. At least two sitting county supervisors on opposite sides of the political aisle aren't on board with postponing the county process that is scheduled to end with a June 24th budget vote. The District 1 election is April 8th, but if no candidate wins more than 50% of votes, the top two finishers will compete in a July 1 runoff. County code calls for the Board of Supervisors to approve the budget for the fiscal year that begins in July by the fourth week of June, unless the board finds it impractical to do so. That means a majority vote by the Board of Supervisors is likely needed to formally change that schedule. Supervisors Joel Anderson and Tara Lawson Remmer said Wednesday they don't want to do that, meaning that it's highly unlikely to happen, at least formally. County spokesperson Tammy Glenn wrote in a Wednesday email that there has been no action by current supervisors to adjust this process, and that Chief Administrative Officer Ebony Shelton is preparing to release her recommended budget on May 1. Glenn also noted that the District 1 administrative staffers are continuing to support their constituents, and that all board officers are sharing details about how to participate in the budget process. The county is committed to proposing a balanced recommended budget that responds to the region's needs while prioritizing mandated services and identifying ways to reduce costs given current financial challenges, Glenn wrote, hinting at a projected $138.5 million budget deficit. Lawson Remmer says she's not inclined to postpone the budget process, including public budget hearings, as the county faces federal cuts. Yet she expects current divisions between Republicans and Democrats on the board to translate into the delayed approval of the county budget, despite the scheduled June vote. She doesn't expect a budget to be approved until the new District 1 supervisor is sworn in, and believes that the supervisor will be the deciding vote on the county's budget. Lawson Remmer wrote in a statement, "Delaying an initial vote would only delay the public budget hearings, but given political realities would have no actual impact on when the budget is adopted. In short, this debate is a bit of a red herring because our board is at an impasse, split 2-2. So the reality is that no budget will be adopted until a fifth supervisor is sworn in." Republican Supervisor Joel Anderson also doesn't want to postpone the process and notes that the county approved a budget after former Supervisor Nathan Fletcher's resignation from the District 4 seat in 2023. Anderson says a delay in the passage of the county's budget punishes over 600,000 constituents who live in the unincorporated communities, communities that he represents. He also added that the county can adjust its budget with 4 votes after June approval to incorporate potential changes. District candidate John McCann, a fellow Republican who is now Chula Vista mayor, also doesn't seem interested in a delay. The true debate is not about delaying the budget vote, but what the new District 1 supervisor would do to fix the county's $140 million plus structural deficit, McCann wrote in an email. Democratic candidate Vivian Moreno, a San Diego council member who was also seeking the District 1 seat, didn't respond to a request from Voice of San Diego for comments. Spokespeople for fellow Republican supervisor Jim Desmond and Democratic supervisor Monica Montgomery Stepp, who won Fletcher's former board seat in 2023, also didn't return messages.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
California Attorney General Rob Bonta has scored another key victory in federal court. Trump-appointed Judge Mary McElroy issued a temporary restraining order to stop the Trump administration from clawing back over $11 billion in public health funding from state and local health departments. California stands to lose over $972 million, according to Bonta. The action came in a lawsuit led by Bonta and joined by 23 states as well as the District of Columbia. The suit was filed against the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and its director, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. Judge McElroy stated after a hearing, the likelihood of success on the merits is extremely strong. She said the record is voluminous, with credible allegations of irreparable harm if funding stops. On March 24th, HHS sent termination notices with no advance warning to state and local public health agencies nationwide. HHS sought to end federal funds appropriated by Congress through COVID-19-related laws. Bonta says in a press release, without this essential public health funding, vital programs that serve millions of Californians, including children, rural communities, and nursing homes, will be jeopardized. The administration claims the grants are no longer necessary because the pandemic is over, but the state attorneys general allege in their suit that termination is illegal for several reasons. First, terminations of grants for cause are only allowed if there was a material failure to comply with grant terms, and there's no evidence that this happened. Second, federal law requires advance notice and a right to a hearing before a grant may be terminated for substance abuse and mental health services, which are included under those state grants. Third, the suit contends, the termination is arbitrary and capricious, assuming, among other things, that all appropriations were only for use during the pandemic. But HHS granted many extensions, and no individual assessments of grants have been done. The money was already in the hands of state and local health departments, and was allowed to be used for non-COVID purposes, including responding to that deadly measles outbreak in Texas. Judge McElroy has proposed scheduling a hearing on the preliminary injunction on April 13th, The Hill reports. For East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This Wednesday, April 9th, La Mesa Councilmember Laura Lothian will host a town hall community discussion on a battery storage facility proposed on El Paso Street. Battery storage facilities are key to expanding renewable energy production such as wind and solar energy, which enable power to be used when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. That being said, lithium-ion battery storage facilities have also sparked fires, most notably one that occurred at Otay Mesa Battery Storage Site, which led to nearby businesses being forced to evacuate for 2 weeks. To combat potential fires in the future, La Mesa City Manager Greg Kimura has proposed that La Mesa's site be smaller and compartmentalized, with a number of safeguards in place to help reduce the risk of fire. Considering that the La Mesa site is directly adjacent to homes, with shopping and businesses nearby, residents and property owners have raised their concerns over the negative impacts this could bring. This town hall is an opportunity for any residents in the area to ask questions and learn more. It'll be taking place at the Brew Coffee Spot on 6101 Lake Murray Boulevard, running from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April 9th. Reporting from East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Juliet Sanders.
Some student loan borrowers are seeing their payment plans suspended and their payments rising due to changes implemented by President Donald Trump's administration. Around 43 million Americans have some kind of student loan debt, according to Newsweek. The Education Department reports that Americans collectively have $1.5 trillion in student debt nationwide. Trump has begun the process of dismantling the Education Department. Nearly half of all Education Department workers are being laid off as the agency undergoes major restructuring. The Trump administration also got rid of online and paper applications for income-driven repayment plans from the federal aid website, Newsweek reports. This change occurred as the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals blocked the income-driven repayment plans in February. This means that former President Joe Biden's Saving on a Valuable Education, SAVE, SAVE plan, and the public service loan forgiveness options are no longer available. Now that these income-driven repayment plans are being suspended, borrowers can't qualify for potential forgiveness or lower monthly payments based on their income or family size. Many borrowers will also see monthly payments increase because of these changes. SAVE allowed 8 million borrowers to work towards student loan forgiveness and to be able to ignore their student loans for months. However, forbearance is scheduled to end this year, with the first payments due in December. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, PSLF, allowed public service employees to have their student loan balances cleared after 10 years of minimum payments. Also, any payments that borrowers make no longer count towards the 120 qualifying payments they need to get to student loan forgiveness under the PSLF. PSLF allowed public service employees to have their student loan balances cleared after 10 years of minimum payments. Trump's executive order claims the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program misdirected tax dollars into activist programs, sometimes through criminal means. But the program provided loan forgiveness to help incentivize people to take jobs that might otherwise be hard to fill, such as public health jobs on Native American reservations and public defender attorneys who could earn far more in private practice. An hours-long outage on Wednesday, March 12th affected the federal website for student loans and financial aid. The National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators received reports of users experiencing technical issues and having trouble completing the application for federal student aid. The Education Department has reduced its staff to about 2,000 since Trump took office, including over 300 people cut from the federal student aid program. Elisa Canchola Banez, policy director at the Student Borrower Protection Center, says that borrowers should download their payment history from the Federal Student Aid portal, screenshot tracking information if they're on a plan that allows for forgiveness, and reach out to Congress members to help with their case. Kevin Thompson, a finance expert and CEO of the 9i Capital Group, told Newsweek, "Borrowers should expect higher payments moving forward, which could lead to a surge in defaults and credit score hits." If the Trump administration takes a harder stance on student loan relief, things may become even more challenging for those struggling to repay. Michael Ryan, a finance expert and the founder of MichaelRyanMoney.com, says that many payments now don't even cover accruing interest, creating negative amortization, where loan balances grow despite regular payments. So high-balance borrowers with moderate incomes could end up in perpetual debt if forgiveness timelines are eliminated, as proposed, he warns. Ryan expects a spike in default increases in May, as millions of borrowers see payments going up by an average of $200 a month. Trump has signed an executive order to move student loans to the Small Business Administration on the same day that agency announced it was cutting 40% of its workforce, according to The Hill. Moving student loans to the SBA, which has no background or familiarity with the student loan program, will only make things worse for borrowers, Banez predicts. Some experts are advising borrowers to reach out to their loan officers and carefully document their repayment efforts, according to The Hill. Borrowers are in a precarious situation, with millions caught in limbo, as the Trump administration seeks to take away student loan forgiveness programs that were established and expanded by former President Biden. Currently, The Hill reports, advocates say they have little hope to offer the 45 million individuals with federal student loans impacted by Trump's drastic changes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert from the County of San Diego. The county is advising people not to eat locally harvested mussels, clams, scallops, or oysters unless they were purchased from a state-certified commercial shellfish harvester or dealer. Shellfish safety notifications also have been issued in Los Angeles and Santa Barbara counties. In each county, dangerous levels of domoic acid, which can cause amnesic shellfish poisoning, have been detected in locally harvested mussels. The naturally occurring domoic acid toxin can cause illness or death in humans. Cooking does not destroy this toxin. The warnings do not apply to shellfish sold at stores from approved sources, such as those sold at local markets or restaurants, because state law allows only state-certified commercial shellfish harvesters or dealers to sell to restaurants and markets. Shellfish sold by certified harvesters and dealers are subject to frequent mandatory state testing to monitor for toxins. The symptoms of amnesic shellfish poisoning can happen from 30 minutes to 24 hours after eating toxic seafood. In mild cases, symptoms may include vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal cramps, headache, and dizziness, with symptoms resolving in a few days. But in severe cases, a person may experience trouble breathing, confusion, disorientation, cardiovascular instability, seizures, permanent loss of short-term memory, coma, or death. The California Department of Public Health will continue local sampling to determine when sport-harvested shellfish is safe to eat again. The California Department of Public Health has a toll-free shellfish information line that you can call at 800-553-4133. Marine mammals are also susceptible to domoic acid. Sea lions poisoned by this acid have attacked humans recently off California's coastline. The public is reminded to maintain a safe distance of at least 50 yards from any injured or deceased marine mammal. Although you cannot get domoic acid from the sea lions directly, these are large animals and protected species that need to be given space for their safety and the public's. Sick marine animals can be reported to SeaWorld Rescue by calling 800-541-7325, and dead marine mammals and sea turtles can be reported by calling the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration at 858-546-7162.
A new bill to make car shopping more transparent goes before the California Senate Transportation Committee tomorrow. Senate Bill 766 would require dealers to disclose the full out-the-door price before a purchase. The legislation is meant to prevent people from getting tricked by offers that require certain add-ons. Democratic State Senator Ben Allen of Santa Monica is its sponsor.
People need to be able to really understand what they're spending. Some car dealers, you walk in and you're basically upsold. Folks, they've ended up spending a lot more than they thought they were going to spend when they walked into the dealership.
The bill would require dealers to tell consumers when an add-on is optional, and it would require them to get customer approval before any add-ons. The Biden administration tried to put the rule in place nationally last December, but a judge invalidated the attempt. The Trump administration is not expected to revive it. The California Chamber of Commerce opposes new regulations on dealerships, saying they would lead to more lawsuits against car dealers and to increased costs for consumers. Allen says he hopes the bill will do the opposite.
By giving consumers some extra time and having greater transparency about what exactly they're spending, it'll reduce the likelihood for folks to file litigation to remedy the issue.
The bill would also give customers who bought a used car 3 days to return a vehicle for a full refund with a small restocking fee. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
A federal judge has found that the Trump administration violated a court order to unfreeze $3 trillion in Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, funding to states intended to help victims recover from natural disasters. On April 4th, U.S. District Judge John J. McConnell Jr. in Rhode Island ordered the Trump administration to immediately comply with the court order and release the funds to the states. The action followed a lawsuit by attorneys general from 23 states, including California, and a preliminary injunction. Specifically, the court found that FEMA's current freeze violates the court's preliminary injunction issued earlier. California Attorney General Rob Bonta says the court order makes it unequivocally clear the Trump administration's reckless effort to hold up millions in emergency funds is unlawful. He adds, "We won't stand idly by as we continue to see the Trump administration breaking the law, and we'll be closely monitoring to ensure that the administration follows the court's order and critical funds are released." The current FEMA freezes have not affected Los Angeles wildfire recovery funds, but have affected wildfire recovery funding in other states, including for the devastating Maui wildfires in Hawaii. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
A new chapter in health education access will begin in East County on April 7th as the Grossmont Healthcare District unveils its new Mobile Outreach Library. The launch coincides with the beginning of National Library Week and celebrates the district's continued commitment to bridging healthcare and information gaps for all of its residents. The Mobile Outreach Library, or MOL, affectionately referred to as MOLLY, is the latest innovation from the district's Health and Wellness Library, designed to bring reliable health resources directly to underserved and remote communities across the district's 750 square mile region. The initiative reflects a growing awareness that many residents, especially seniors, students, and low-income families, face barriers to physically visiting the library in La Mesa. Amy Abrams, Chief Community Health Officer for Grossmont Healthcare District, says health literacy is an essential foundation of community wellness. With MOLLY, we are literally meeting people where they are, ensuring that reliable health information is within reach, whether they live in Campo, Santee, or anywhere in between. Designed to be more than just a library on wheels, the Mobile Outreach Library will provide community-tailored library services, including library card registration, digital literacy training, and facilitate research requests for people looking for more in-depth health information on certain conditions. Additionally, residents will be able to receive information about county services available through other nonprofit health and community partners working in East County. Holland Kessinger, head librarian for the GHD Health and Wellness Library, says libraries have always found ways to get information and resources to the people. In the past, sometimes even by horse, mule, or bicycle, MOLLY carries forward that proud tradition by serving as a beacon of health information. The Mobile Outreach Library will serve locations on a rotating schedule, including senior housing communities, schools, community centers, health fairs, and rural towns such as Tecate, Descanso, and Pine Valley. The Mobile Library's operating budget for 2025 is projected at $25,000 and is expected to decrease as the program stabilizes. Quarterly evaluations are planned. Randy Lanack, a member of the publicly elected Grossmont Healthcare District Board of Directors, who represents many of the district's most rural communities, says, "This initiative shows that we are not waiting for people to come to us. We're going to them. As stewards of taxpayer resources, it's our duty to ensure every resident, regardless of where they live, has the opportunity to make informed choices about their health. To request a visit from the Mobile Outreach Library, you can contact the district at grossmonthealthcare.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
The beginning of April saw the kickoff for the annual Springtime Blood Drive, an event the County of San Diego has hosted for the past 41 years. This event, which began Tuesday of this week, will run for the entire month of April. On average, 1 in 7 people hospitalized will need blood, and blood banks supplying hospitals rely on donations to avoid shortages. While only 3% of people in the United States donate blood each year, the County of San Diego, alongside the San Diego Blood Bank, uses programs such as the Community Guardians Program to create a critical year-round supply. This annual blood drive is one of the largest collection events organized by the San Diego Blood Bank, and is a great chance for people to provide for the community in a direct and simple way. The process of donation usually takes around an hour. Donating just 450 milliliters can potentially save up to 3 lives. For more information on blood drive locations and schedule, please visit San Diego Blood Bank website. Here you can find the closest mobile center to you, as well as schedule an appointment for the most convenient time. Again, if interested in making a life-saving donation, please visit the San Diego Blood Bank website.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's Destination East County. It's springtime here in East County and the season for flower festivals, including Daffodil Days and a Lilac Festival, both in Julian, plus Sweet Pea Days in Flint Springs. There are also Easter egg hunts and bunny rides aboard a historic train in Campo. Plus, you can watch Aerobatics Daredevils take wing in a competition in Borrego Springs. Head to Lakeside's Rodeo and Western Days Parade, or roller skate outdoors at the Viejas Outlet Center in Alpine. This April, you can also enjoy a Roaring Twenties Centennial Party atop Mount Helix, a taste of Lakeside, plus a wine tasting festival in Ramona. And here are the details. Southern California's largest outdoor roller rink will open for spring and summer season at Viejas Outlet Mall on April 4th. Skate rentals are available. After skating, visitors can also enjoy shop or dining at the Outlet Center's many stores and eateries. You can learn more at viejasoutletcenter.com. The Pacific Southwest Railway Museum in Campo invites you to come aboard the Bunny Train departing Saturdays and Sundays from April 5th through 20th. Trains depart at 10:30, 1 p.m., and 2:30 p.m. After your ride through our beautiful backcountry, a treasure trove of hidden eggs awaits youngsters at the museum's exhibit building. Children can trade eggs for prizes and meet the Easter Bunny, who will be chilling out in his charming garden, ready for cuddles and photo opportunities. For more information and reservations, you can visit the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum site at psrm.org. The Main Avenue Revitalization Association invites you to the Taste of Lakeside, its upcoming fundraiser April 8th from 5 to 8 p.m. This event brings together 10 local restaurants, including Cali Stack, Ranch House, Octavio's, Eastbound, Yogurt Barn, The Parks, Caffeine Queens, and the VFW, offering attendees the opportunity to sample culinary delights. Tickets may be purchased from Mary's Donuts or from the Lakeside Historical Society on Saturdays, or from any Main Avenue Revitalization Association member. All funds raised will be directly supporting downtown historic Lakeside. You're invited to join the 100th anniversary celebration of Mount Helix Park with a Roaring Twenties-themed party on April 12th from 4:30 to 8 p.m. in the Mount Helix Nature Theater. Enjoy delicious appetizers and dinner from Becker's Catering, followed by dueling pianos and dancing under the stars. Beer, wine, and soft drinks are also included. All tickets include shuttle service to and from the parking lot, entertainment, appetizers, dinner, dessert, beer, wine, and soft drinks. For tickets, visit mounthelixpark.org/100. That's Mount Helix, MTHELIX, park.org. The Ramona Valley Vintners Association and the Ramona Chamber of Commerce invite you to Cheers to the Valley Wine Festival on Saturday, April 5th from 12 to 4 p.m. at Beegent Ranch in Ramona. The event includes catered small bites, arts and craft vendors, live music by local artists, unlimited tastings from local wineries, and a complimentary tasting glass. For tickets and a list of participating wineries and vendors, you can visit RamonaChamber.com. An international aerobatics competition will be held at the Borrego Springs Airport Thursday through Saturday, April 10th through 12th, organized by the International Aerobatic Club's Chapter 36, or IAC 36. A highlight for viewers is Saturday's 4-minute freestyle flight set to music, usually involving smoke, flown by top pilots. Thursday is practice and registration, while Friday features contest flights all day long. You can also stop by the Propeller Bar and Grill, where you can enjoy food and drinks, plus a rooftop deck to view the flying. The IAC Chapter 36 is based in Borrego Springs and promotes precision aerobatics through coaching, competition, and camaraderie. The Borrego Airport boasts the world's finest permanent surface wavered aerobatics box. For a full schedule of events, visit IAC36.org. Julian Farm and Orchard invites you to Daffodil Days, which continue each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday now through April 13th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. In addition to you-pick daffodils, visitors can also enjoy other activities for a fee, including a petting zoo, rock climbing, swings, picnic area, a tractor-pulled hayride, and more. Find details at julianfarmandorchard.com. The City of Santee invites you to hop on over to Santee's Bunny Trail on Saturday, April 12th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Santee Trolley Square. Guests can enjoy photos with the bunny, games, crafts, face painting, giveaways, and carnival rides. Fort Cross Adventures in Julian hosts its Spring Lilac Festival from April 19th through May 11th on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Sundays from noon to 5 p.m. General admission includes entry into a lilac maze, family farm area, and more. A festival activity package adds a wagon ride, treasure hunt, interactive reptile show, visits with farm animals, a hoedown and jug band show, paint and craft, and lilac-themed candle dipping. Additional activities are available for a fee. Pre-registration for the Lilac Festival is advised, and you can get reservations at fortcross.com/lilac-festival. Visitors can also purchase fresh lilac bouquets at the farm stand 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Summer's Past Farms in Flynn Springs invites you to Sweet Pea Day. Saturday, April 19th, you can stroll through a towering, fragrant maze of these old-fashioned, dainty flowers, take photos, cut, and make your own bouquet from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. as long as the blooms last. Summer's Past Farms is located in Flint Springs between El Cajon and Alpine. You can get more information at summerspastfarms.com. The 61st Annual Lakeside Rodeo takes place April 24th through 27th at the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds. Events range from barrel racing to bull riding. All proceeds from the Lakeside Rodeo benefit youth and youth groups in Lakeside, such as scholarships for high school seniors, special needs summer camps, the 4-H Club, Future Farmers of America, book giveaways to students, scouting, journalism classes, auto mechanics instruction, youth sports, and the arts. For tickets and more details, you can visit lakesiderodeo.com. And finally, the 60th Annual Western Days Parade in Lakeside steps off starting at 9:35 a.m. on Saturday, April 26th. This year's parade along Main Avenue in downtown Lakeside honors hometown heroes. The parade is organized by the Lakeside Chamber of Commerce. More information is available at lakesidechamber.org. You can find more information on these and more events in our Festivals and Events section at eastcountymagazine.org and on our calendar. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
Santee knows it has to be better when it comes to providing fire protection to its residents. So after a sales tax-funded plan for new fire stations failed in November, the City Council has made improving the essential service as its top priority. The council was already focused on getting a couple of new stations to double the current number, two, to serve a population of more than 60,000. It was building a temporary station off Olive Way, where it formerly used to keep its maintenance operations, and was planning a new station in the north part of the city. But the council was hoping the half-cent hike to local sales taxes would finance the improvements. Not so fast, said voters, who rejected the plan. At its March 12th meeting, the Santee City Council set building new fire stations, along with finding new ways to pay for them, as its number one goal from a list of 10 priorities. City Manager Marlene Best listed what the city is already doing, including adding new trucks, more emergency medical personnel, completing the temporary station, designing a permanent station at the operations yard, and conducting a study for a third station in the north part of the city. Then she said, "We're also looking at the potential for a new funding measure that could mean another sales tax hike or raising taxes on property owners." The rest of the list mirrored what the priorities were 2 years ago, with Best giving updates whether the goals were accomplished and their status. The number two priority, annexing West Hills Parkway and surrounding parcels, is still up in the air. Best said, "The council wants to work with one property owner to ensure his project conforms to Santee's higher standards. The fact is that this property, indeed all of West Hills Parkway, remains in the city of San Diego, so whatever Santee wants could be ignored, as was the case when San Diego approved the Castle Rock development, now called Weston." Priority number three is to maintain focus on road paving, especially on West Hills Parkway. Fourth, expand economic opportunities through a recently adopted arts and entertainment district. The city has a vision of turning the town center and its surrounding area into a village that would feature art galleries, dance studios, theaters, restaurants, and bars. The city also will be deciding on who will run a total of 4 cannabis shops in the industrial-zoned areas of the city by early July. The fifth priority, a new building permit system, has been implemented, which should make it easier to get all those new galleries and theaters built faster. A new app also makes interactions with the city easier. The sixth priority is to continue working to reduce risks of fire from homeless folks camping in the city, particularly in the San Diego riverbed. Best said, "Since the city hired an outreach person 2 years ago, the number of encampments cleaned was 120, including 16 in the last month." She also noted that a recent count of the homeless population in Santee fell to 46, down from 112 a year ago, though it's unclear whether those people were transitioned into housing or simply moved encampments elsewhere. The seventh priority, looking for ways to improve the trails linked to Mission Trails Park, particularly at Big Rock Park, was put on the back burner, Best said, because most of the land remains in San Diego County, not the city. But the council wants to make safety on its trails a priority, ranking this eighth. Options to make trails safer is the possible adoption of a video camera system, now in the testing phase, that would be monitored by the Sheriff's Department. Number nine is the continued reduction of the city's liabilities involving pensions it must pay to retired workers, which has been accomplished by making higher annual contributions to that budget expense over the last 4 years. The 10th priority has already been achieved, completing a development impact fee and adopting a new set of fees charged to new development that went into effect March 10th. Though not officially listed as a priority, the council also wants to adopt a funding plan for a community center behind the Cameron YMCA. A workshop on this is scheduled for April 9th, but with a cost estimate a few years ago at $50 million and pressures from building new fire stations, that may have to be put on the back burner, even though the project has been favored by several council members over the years. Reporting for East County Magazine from Santee, this is John Tidwell.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. The White House wants to dismantle the Department of Education. While Congress would need to approve it, rural school districts, more dependent on its funds, fear the worst. Former Roseburg, Oregon teacher Mickey Hall worries teachers could walk away.
The chilling effect is, oh my gosh, why would anybody go into education? I mean, first of all, they don't pay enough. And secondly, now they're not even hiring people, so I'm not going to do that.
Many rural school districts face budget cliffs as pandemic funds phase out. Others could lose their part of $200 million federal dollars due to Congress's failure to reauthorize the Secure Rural Schools Act. Superintendent Jamie Green at California's Trinity Alps District says the government is undermining a keystone of rural communities.
Rural schools are not failing. We're working as hard as we can for those children.
A resolution against privatizing the Postal Service is moving in Congress after rallies in communities big and small defending the institution. For the second time, the Trump administration has floated selling the USPS or parts of it. Brian Renfro is with the Letter Carriers Union.
This is an attack that is disproportionate to the people that live in rural America, which is over 50 million people.
In Missouri, Kirby Ricketts has been with the Rural Letter Carriers Association for more than 12 years.
If it's not cost-effective to take that bag of medicine or that prescription, that last mile, they're not going to do it if there's not money in it for them.
The Biden administration aimed to boost rural internet with fiber networks, but the current Commerce Department is changing the rules and queuing up Elon Musk's Starlink satellite system to claim millions of dollars already allocated. Drew Garner with the Benton Institute for Broadband and Society says fiber is more expensive up front, but much cheaper and more reliable over time, which can boost benefits.
Fiber is correlated with increased entrepreneurship, increased business revenues, increased uses of telehealth.
Rural households are less likely to have high-speed internet access than their urban and suburban peers. Finally, April showers bring May flowers, but for baseball fans, it's the start of a season that's too much and never enough. At the drop of a ball cap, fond memories are conjured up for 1951's shot heard round the world. With the Brooklyn Dodgers trailing the New York Giants in the bottom of the ninth, Bobby Thompson hit a game-winning home run. For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Sounds of History on the East County Magazine show. April is Women's History Month. It's an appropriate time to share a story about a remarkable woman from East County's past. Helen Stoddard, a former resident of La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Ramona, was a prominent leader in the fight to win women the right to vote, as well as in the temperance movement. She even earned a place in history at the national political level. Born in 1850 in Wisconsin, Stoddard earned a teaching degree at Genesee Wesleyan Seminary in New York, graduating as valedictorian in 1873. She married Shepherd Stoddard and had two sons, one of whom died in infancy. They lived briefly in Nebraska, but soon her husband's health was failing, so the family moved to Florida. And after he died in 1875, when Helen Stoddard was just 25 years old, she and her surviving young son moved to Texas to be near her parents. There, she became president of the Texas State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, concerned over the negative impacts of alcoholism on women and their families. She also served on the faculty of Fort Worth University and helped establish a women's industrial arts college that today is known as Texas Women's University, where two buildings were named after her. She became an activist, lobbying successfully for a pure food law and laws against cocaine, gambling, child labor, raising the age of protection for girls from 12 to 15 in Texas, and more. She spent 3 months in Mexico as an organizer and twice served as a delegate to world conventions of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She also wrote an article on the Texas suffrage movement for Susan B. Anthony's book, History of Woman Suffrage. In 1910, Helen Stoddard and her son moved to La Mesa, where she was soon elected president of the La Mesa Women's Club, which incidentally was founded in 1902 and is the city's oldest active service club today. She also headed up the local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Society, forerunner of the Prohibition movement. Local women embarked on barnstorming tours across the county to win support from men for women to gain the right to vote in California. The Mesa's newspaper and other local papers editorialized in favor of granting this right, since progressives in the region recognized that women would be key allies in local political issues and supporting social reforms related to child labor, public health, and regulating alcohol and vice. The La Mesa Scout editorialized that the right of women to vote is as absolute as that of a man. In October 1911, California's legislature amended the state constitution, granting women the right to vote. Days later, Helen Stoddard loaded up motor cars with about 40 members of the La Mesa Women's Club and headed to the Registrar of Voters office in downtown San Diego, registering them all to vote. In La Mesa, then known as La Mesa Springs, a battle was brewing over incorporation to become a city. Supporters wanted the city to control its own water supply and support public education, among other goals. But there was strong opposition, mainly from ranchers who feared that their taxes would go up. Early efforts at incorporation faltered until the women got involved and won the right to vote. A meeting at the La Mesa Opera House on December 1, 1911 ended in disorder without a vote on whether to incorporate after vocal opponents showed up. Supporters brought their case to the supervisors, and among the speakers arguing to the supervisors was suffrage leader Helen Stoddard. The district attorney reviewed the petition but rejected it at first for not meeting requirements to publish notices 3 times over 2 weeks. So the supporters circulated a new petition and adjusted boundaries to remove some of their key opponents. In February 1912, a new meeting was convened at the city's Opera House, a building that today is the Por Favor restaurant in downtown La Mesa. Citizens nominated candidates for public office in case the incorporation petition passed, and Helen Stoddard was nominated to serve, but she declined. Turned out she had higher ambitions, and we'll tell you about that in a minute. On February 7, 1912, a special election was held, and the incorporation measure passed with help from La Mesa's newly registered women. Soon after, Stoddard declared her intention to run for Congress on the Prohibition Party ticket. She was the first woman in California to seek national office. Her campaign targeted women with the slogan, "A vote for Helen Stoddard is a vote for the home." She didn't win, but she did draw over 1,300 votes out of over 20,000 cast for 5 candidates in the race. A year later, she and her son Robert and his wife moved to Lemon Grove, where they spent the next 10 years, and in 1923, they moved to Ramona, where her son raised turkeys and chickens, while his mother continued her work in the temperance movement from their home overlooking the Ramona High School. In 1920, Helen Stoddard was elected president of the California State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and she served as a California delegate to the Congress Against Alcoholism in Washington, D.C. After her son's death in 1936 in Ramona, Stoddard and her daughter-in-law moved to Texas. Helen Stoddard died there in January 1941 at age 90, and her body was returned to San Diego for burial next to her son at Greenwood Memorial Park. She had lived through the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and the dawn of World War II. Born in the pioneer era, in her lifetime she advanced education of women and saw women win the right to vote, helped lead the successful fight for La Mesa to become a city, ran for national political office, fought for the passage of the Prohibition Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but also lived to see that repealed. Throughout her life, she was a tireless fighter for the rights of women and girls, touching the lives of people across our nation to this day.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Bueco, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.